Hope you had a good week this week. I sat down last night going over my notes and watching the hockey game. I often hear people say, hockey is boring because it usually ends up 1-0 or 2-1. No, that's soccer. That's boring. The game last night, my team, the Red Wings, were down 7-2 after two periods, and I kind of gave up. It was on the screen, but I kind of gave up watching it. Next thing I knew, it was 7-4. Then it was 7-5. Then it was 7-6. Then it was 8-6. It ended up being 10-7. We still lost, but it was an exciting game, an exciting thing. It reminded me of my youth. We called it pond hockey. Nobody played defense. You just let everybody shoot the goalie as much as they wanted to, and you just wanted the puck so you could score when it was your turn to do so. And that's about what they did last night. Defense just went out the window, and those goalies were left all by themselves. Both teams switched goalies halfway through. The Red Wings switched back goalies to their starter again after a little while because that guy just got peppered with too many shots. But it was a fun Saturday night. I know most of you are saying, oh, Ohio State was not involved, so it doesn't matter. But it was fun. It got me all ready for this morning. Now I'm going to pepper you. Are you ready? You're the goalie. I'm going to shoot at you. All right, the book of Acts, chapter 21. Travis, come and help me, please. If there's anybody that doesn't have Acts, chapter 21, I've got three of them here, I think. Thank you, sir. Acts, chapter 21. Going through the birth, the history, the growth of the church, the expansion of it around the world. We live in a sad, sad day today, and we'll mention it simply as a prayer request in our morning service. I have been bombarded, and I don't mean in a bad way, I've been bombarded this week with the names of good missionaries in the Ukraine that everybody's asking prayer for. We don't support, well, we support the Ruse, but they're back here in the States. But Casey Klein is a missionary that went through years ago. He's in Ukraine. Other people have mentioned other names, even national Ukrainian pastors. One, I think it's Brother Casey Klein, is at the border, I think, to Romania, whatever's on the east, or Poland over there. And he is in like a 5 or 6 day line trying to get out of Ukraine as the Russian troops are moving across there. And they've got 2 days worth of food in the car with them, and they're just in this line waiting, and there's nothing they can do but wait their turn to try to get out. It is chaos over there. And we certainly need to be praying for the Christians in Ukraine. I know the political situation, all that's one thing. But behind every political thing, there is a spiritual force. We learn nothing else from the Bible, we learn that the political stuff is a front. All right, it's what gets everybody's attention, gets everybody bottled up and worked up. But the important stuff's always behind the scenes, and it's always spiritual. And here with this thing with the Ukraine, it's the missionaries that have been doing work. I think I mentioned Wednesday night or last Sunday that Brother Ruth said that all the missionaries, even in Russia, are all Ukrainian or Ukrainian trained. They went to Bible institutes in the Ukraine and they were trained there, or they're Ukrainian men in Russia. And that's what's under siege right now. And they are either deciding to stay or they're deciding to flee. And I, again, in studying the life of the Apostle Paul, we don't judge either way which decision they make. If they decide to stay, pray for them. If they decide to flee, pray for them. We don't judge people in that situation because we have no idea what we would do if we weren't in that place. Brother Klein, these missionaries, most of them have wives and children, and they are trying to get to safety. Some are standing, but pray for that. Pray for the spiritual situation in Ukraine. I'm not qualified to talk about the political part. I know all the information there, and Brother Rue filled me in on a lot of that stuff about why Russia is trying to get those two provinces in the west and or in the east, and now moving across and all that kind of stuff. And I know one person called me and asked to pray for their son in the army who is being deployed to Poland. And I got researching and looked a little bit, and Poland is right on the west side of Ukraine, and our troops are amassing over in that area. The army's sending people over, so it could be a mess. A lot of preachers are preaching this morning from Ezekiel. I think it's 37, 38, and all that stuff. That's not this. That's not this. That is the battle of Armageddon. That is after the rapture. That's in the tribulation. That's after all that. And so this has got people going screwy all over the place. But this has the makings of a World War III. We've always said that there's two world wars in history and there's one on the horizon. That's the battle of Armageddon with all the world together. But that could be World War IV if this one turns out to be three. So, and all the repercussions. Anyways, all that stuff going on. Pray for the missionaries in Ukraine. Pray for their safety and God's protection over them. Acts chapter 21, we've covered the first 17 verses here as Paul is making his trip back to Jerusalem. And we looked at that trip to Jerusalem in verse 1 to 17, page 2, with the brethren at Jerusalem, now making a travel across land by foot and going to Jerusalem. We'll pick up in verse number 18. Well, verse 17, look at this. And when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. All right, here Paul is from this all the way from Macedonia and Achaia. He's traveled to Asia. Now he sailed south of Cyprus, back to Syria, back to Israel, and now across foot from Caesarea to Ptolemais and Tyre, and now down here, finally arriving in Jerusalem in time for Pentecost. That has been Paul's desire for months now, was to get to Jerusalem in time for Pentecost. Again, we have looked, and I believe have seen in Scripture, that that was a mistaken desire. That God did not want Paul to go to Jerusalem. He's not called to the Jews. That's not his people. As far as his ministry, Peter was the apostle to the Jews, Paul to the uncircumcision, to the Gentiles. And yet he has made it his personal mission to get back to Jerusalem. And on the way he has made mistake upon mistake. They've built up and things are not going good. Now he finally gets to Jerusalem. And in verse 17, the brethren, the people in Jerusalem, the average, the common people, the church members, receive him gladly. But then we get to verse number 18. And we're calling this, and I think I gave this to you last week, is Roman numeral 2, the test with the Jews. Roman numeral 1 was the trip to Jerusalem. Number 2 is the test with the Jews. And if Paul is going to be required or asked to do something that is against his conscience, that he has preached against, that he should absolutely not do, and he's going to do it. Because his decision-making process right now is amiss. He's out of the will of God. And when you're out of the will of God, your decisions are wrong. No matter how pretty you paint them up, no matter how spiritual you talk, when you're out of the will of God, your decisions are not going to be right. That's why it's so important to stay in the will of God and know that your life is in the will of God, because that's the only way to make right decisions. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart and lean not to thine own understanding, Paul. And again, I've said this with apologies to Paul over and over again. I'm not trying to judge him or demean him or belittle him. But great men are not always wise, Solomon said. And Paul is making some mistakes in his decisions here. So the test with the Jews, upon finally arriving in Jerusalem, it says in verse 17, the church received them gladly. However, the next day, they appear before James and the elders, and things are not quite as good. In verse 18 it says, and the day following, Paul went in with us unto James. And you remember, James is now the leader of the church at Jerusalem, back in Acts chapter 15. Paul went up to Jerusalem to tell them about how God had opened the door of grace to the Gentiles. And the church received him there, and they had to have that debate with the James and the elders. Here's the problem, and I might be getting ahead of myself. Here's the problem with the church at Jerusalem. Its glory days are behind it. As we've talked about already, God has moved his spiritual headquarters from Jerusalem to Antioch. In Acts chapter 11, they were first called Christians at Antioch. The missionaries were sent out in Acts chapter 13 from Antioch. God has overlooked Jerusalem. Jerusalem's days are in the past. They're still there. They're still functioning. They are still a large church. They are still in the thousands. But there's no evangelistic fervor. They're taking care of their own, Acts chapter 6. They're distributing to the needs of their own, but there is no outreach. There's no ministry. In Acts chapter 8, the persecution that arose about Stephen caused many in Jerusalem to be scattered abroad because of the persecution. They were the witnesses. They were the ones taking the gospel out. The ones that stayed in Jerusalem were not under any persecution because they weren't really doing anything. And in the meantime, what crept in was some false doctrine. And that is the Judaizers, or those that were not willing to give up the law. That said, hey, we are Jews first, and even though we've been saved by grace, we still need to keep the law of Moses. No, you don't. That's wrong. But the church has been infiltrated by some of this influence, and now it's nothing more than an organization. It's not reaching out. It's not doing anything. And here Paul comes back after his third missionary journey. He's back there at Pentecost, and he comes before the church, and it says about them in verse number 19, and when he had saluted them, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by His ministry. All right, this is in our notes, the declaration of Paul, verse 18 and 19. He declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles. Paul gave them a detailed report on what was going on his missionary journeys. He told them what happened in Philippi and Thessalonica and Ephesus and Galatia, the region of Galatia, all these different things. Paul gave them a report, and they, I'm reading between the lines, they half-heartedly said, well, praise the Lord. They were glad to hear about these little pockets of Gentiles here and there that were coming to know Christ. Oh, the church at Ephesus running maybe 80 people, and up in Thessalonica there's 40 or 50 up there, and over in the other place there's a handful here and there. But notice their response in verse number 20. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord. Now that's a good thing. But again, by what follows, I think it was a half-hearted praise the Lord. Because it says in verse 20 that they went on to say unto him, thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe. And I believe, if I can say it this way, that they are saying, well, that's wonderful that you've reached pockets of Gentiles throughout Asia, Achaia, and Macedonia. But look around you. Look at the thousands that are gathered here together right now. They were having a competition. They were saying, oh, you've started these churches here, Paul, with a small number of Gentiles in each place. But look at what we have here at Jerusalem. Look how big our church is. Look how many people we've got coming. We have thousands. Now, I'm of the mindset, and I've already said it, there was no evangelistic fervor. There was no outreach ministry. They weren't running bus routes. They weren't giving out gospel tracts. They weren't doing assigned ministry. They weren't going door to door. None of that was going on in the church. But they said, we have thousands. Well, you know where they came from? Look back at Acts chapter 2. I know this is in your notes there, but look at Acts chapter 2. This is the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem. And Acts 2:41 says, then they that gladly received His word were baptized, and the same day there were added unto them about 3,000 souls. All right, so on the day of Pentecost, the church went from 120 to 3,120. That's pretty good, the day Peter preached on Pentecost. Look over at chapter 4. And verse number 4. Chapter 4 and verse 4. Howbeit many of them which heard the word believed, and the number of the men was about 5,000. This is where Peter and John were standing before the church. So 3,000 in Acts 2, 5,000 in Acts 4. We don't read about another mass movement. We don't read about people in Jerusalem being converted. The next thing we're reading about is Acts 8. They're being sent out at the stoning of Stephen. And it's kind of interesting. Where were the thousands when Stephen was being stoned? What were they doing at that time? Why was there no one coming to his defense? Where were James and the elders when Stephen needed them? They were nowhere to be found. And the church was scattered abroad upon the persecution. And the church at Jerusalem, now these men are saying here in verse number 20, thou seest there are thousands of Jews which believe. Yeah? About 9,000. Maybe a little bit more. But that was from years ago. You know, there's a lot of churches existing on their glory years ago. On what they once were. What they used to do. And that happens when they lose their evangelistic fervor. I remember going to a church in Guernsey County out in the country one time many, many years ago. The little church, I could name it for you, you might recognize it, but it's a little church out in the country. And they had maybe 6 people in the church when I went out to visit it. They had 6 people in the church, but on the walls they had pictures of the church in their heyday. Back in the 60s or the 70s, where there were hundreds of people. Pictures out on the front lawn of that very same church building with hundreds of people out there. What happened? Well, they lost their fervor. They lost their evangelistic spirit. And when that's gone, it's not good. You and I need to pray that we never lose our evangelistic fervor, never lose our desire to see other people come to Christ. Never get excited when somebody trusts Christ as their Savior. That's the life of the church. And so here they are saying, thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe. Notice this. And they are all zealous of the law. That's the problem. The law is over. The law is passed. The law has no bearing. Yet the church at Jerusalem is still stuck in the law. They have been infiltrated by some that may or may not be born again. But they are emphasizing the necessity of the law. Isn't that what Paul's been preaching against for the last 10 years? That by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight? So we've got two opposites going on here. We've got the church at Jerusalem that's saying you're saved by grace, but you've got to keep the law. And you've got Paul out here saying the law is not necessary for salvation, it's not necessary for security, it's not necessary for sanctification, you don't need the law. You've got two opposite ends of the spectrum right there. So the declaration of Paul in verse 18 and 19. Then we find in verse 20 to 26 the demand of the elders. The demand of the elders. Number one, the feigned praise. And feigned is spelled F-E-I-G-N-E-D. Feigned. F-E-I-N-G-E-D. When you feign something, you're faking it. You're pretending. And again, I believe that this praise in verse number 20, and when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said, thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are which believe. We've talked about that already, and that's our first paragraph under feigned. Their initial response was to say, well, praise the Lord. That's what we do out of habit. The Lord be glorified. But Paul, you see how many thousands there are here. And they are all zealous of the law. It says in verse 21, and they are informed of thee, that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. Their accusation is that someone is spreading a rumor. And that rumor is that Paul has been telling people telling Jews not to be circumcised. And that's number 2, verse 21 and verse 22. And that's the false rumor. The false rumor. You know, most rumors are false. Do you remember, some of you, you got to be as old as I am, I guess. Remember back in English class or English composition, if you were going to write an article, you were forbidden to quote anonymous sources. You weren't allowed to do it in journalism. You had to have a source. You had to have someone so that other people could verify that your information is correct. Now, every stinking thing you read in the paper is from an anonymous source. Whether it's sports, this player said he's going to quit this team and go to this, according to an anonymous source. Whether it's politics, whether it's Hollywood, no matter what, it's an anonymous source. That is as dishonest and low-handed as you could possibly be. Nobody can verify that. Nobody can see if it's true or not. And it used to be taboo. And now it's widely accepted by top journalists all around the world. And most of that stuff cannot be verified. And most of it turns out 3 months later to have not been true. That somebody had started a false rumor. And the news is full of stuff where they report stuff, and then they wait 6 months, or 6 months later, it turns out half of what they reported was not even accurate. That's the world we live in today. Here it is in verse number 21. They are informed of thee, Paul. Someone has told them that thou teachest the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. First of all, who said that? Who told them? They're quoting anonymous sources. All right? They are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. Look back at the book of Nehemiah. I like this verse of Nehemiah. Nehemiah wouldn't put up with anonymous sources. Nehemiah chapter 6. We're studying Nehemiah on Wednesday nights. We're only at chapter 4 now, but look at chapter 6. Nehemiah chapter 6, look at verse 8. So some folks have come to, well, verse 6. Wherefore was written, it is reported among the heathen. This is what they're saying to Nehemiah. And Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel. It is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu, they're attributing it to someone, the anonymous heathen. And Gashmu is the reporter that carried the news to them. And it said that the Jews seek to rebel. And notice what Nehemiah says in verse 8. Then said I, and I sent unto him, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them. There's our word, feign. Thou feignest them out of thine own heart. You know what Nehemiah said to them? You're making this up. The heathen didn't say that. Gashmu didn't report it. You've thought this up on your own. You are the source of this rumor. You can never trace the source of rumors. And a lot of folks waste their time trying to do so. Well, you know what so-and-so said? Well, it probably wasn't them. You go to them and they say, well, I heard it from this person. They say, I heard it from that person. You'll never find the source. And I kind of half suspect that here in Acts chapter 20, they are informed of thee that it was the elders themselves that were the source of this wrong information. Those that were zealous after the law and were not pleased with the ministry of the Apostle Paul, instead of just coming right out and saying it, they had to backdoor it. And they said simply, they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after their customs. It's a rumor. And it's a false rumor. Paul was not telling them not to circumcise their children. He just said this, circumcision availeth nothing. Uncircumcision availeth nothing. He wasn't telling the circumcised not to get circumcised or the uncircumcised to get circumcised. He's simply saying, neither one of those things matter anything about your soul's condition. Paul's ministry was contrary to the law. The church at Jerusalem was still stuck in the law. And they made up this rumor saying that Paul had said that. Notice, I think we've got it here. The rumor that Paul was teaching the Jews in Asia, Macedonia, and Achaia was not to circumcise their children was false. Paul constantly referred to the Jews as the circumcision and the Gentiles as the uncircumcision. He also had Timothy in Acts 16, who was half Jew, half Gentile. You remember that. He had him circumcised so his ministry would be more effective to the Jews. He didn't tell Timothy not to do it. He told him to be circumcised. So this is a false rumor. It's not true. The question might be, who informed the Jews in Jerusalem against Paul? And my question is, was it the elders themselves? It's always interesting to look behind the facts and look at the sources and look at who's behind that thing. Acts chapter 21, down to verse number 23. We've looked at the feigned praise and the false rumor. Now look at the four men. Page number 3, the four men, beginning in verse 23. In verse 22, what is it therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. See, the thousands of Jews, the multitude. This is an attempt at intimidation. That's what they're doing against Paul, just like again we've seen in Nehemiah, Sanballat and Tobiah, Gershom, surrounding Jerusalem and trying to intimidate the Jews not to rebuild the walls. Intimidation is a tool of the devil. And here they're trying to intimidate Paul. So they come up with this solution in verse 23. Do therefore this that we say to thee. I'd like to write here that Paul turned and walked away. The Apostle Paul, the writer of 14 books in our New Testament, and these elders at the church of Jerusalem are saying, here's what we want you to do. Here's what you should do. And what they're going to tell Paul to do is contradictory to everything Paul has been preaching for 10 years, yet he does it. Verse number 23. Do therefore this that we say unto thee, we have four men which have a vow on them. This is Old Testament law. Take them and purify thyself with them. Oh, is Paul not pure? He needs to get purified in the temple according to the law of Moses? I don't think so. Take them and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing. And that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. Do you see the problem? Paul's whole ministry has been teaching that you don't have to keep the law. That the law and the prophets were until John. But now we walk by faith and not by sight. Now the commandments are no longer bearing on us. And yet they're saying, we want you to prove to them by going into the temple, being with these that have a vow, shaving their heads, whether Paul did that or not, it's not clear. But he wanted them to associate with them as being keepers of the law, so that he could appease and please the Jews in Jerusalem, not necessarily the church, but all the Jews that had gathered for Pentecost. Verse 25. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, which is none of their business, and from blood and from strangled and from fornication. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification. Now there are Bible teachers that teach and believe that Paul is not doing anything wrong here. And I've tried to read both sides of the argument and come across, and I can't get it. I can't get it where Paul is doing all of this stuff like he did before he got saved. This was Saul of Tarsus. This was his life before he became the Apostle Paul. And he's reverting back and doing that which he did before his conversion, and which he has been telling people for years now not to do. He did it again. And it gets worse, because verse 26 says, to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification, until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. You know what that offering was? According to the Old Testament law? It was the blood of a lamb. So five lambs were slain at the end of this period of vowing, at the end of this period of purification, an offering should be made for every one of them. Paul stood there and watched while they offered a lamb sacrifice for his purification in the temple. Does that not contradict everything you know about the Apostle Paul? How did he get to this point? Because he got out of the will of God. He wasn't supposed to be in Jerusalem. He shouldn't have been listening to the elders in the church of Jerusalem. He had no business in the temple. He had no business making a vow or purifying himself, and sure had no business having an offering made. Now some say, well, that was a money offering made. Well, the Old Testament law wasn't a money offering. It was the shedding of blood. The four men. A solution was proposed by those very same elders that would appease those thousands of Jews. So Paul was to accompany four men as they fulfilled their vows in the temple. The vows included the shaving of the men's heads and animal sacrifices. That's the offering. This, they claimed, would prove that Paul was walking orderly and keeping the law. All of this was contrary to what Paul had been proclaiming for years. So what is the result of all this? The trip to Jerusalem, the test by the Jews, and now number three, the tumult in the temple. And I like this. That's a good sermon title. The tumult in the temple. I get that word tumult from verse 34. The end of the story, some cried one thing, some another among the multitude, when he could not know the certainty for the tumult. That's what the chief captain calls what goes on here now. This riot that takes place when Paul comes out of the temple, because there's going to be some more false accusations given, one upon the other, and Paul's going to get in trouble. And it's the tumult in the temple. That sounds, again, for those of you in my generation, that sounds like a Three Stooges skit to me. The tumult in the tent with King Rootin' Tootin'. You remember him? All right, all that Three Stooges stuff. I like that. You can't watch that today because it's offensive. See, it's violent. It would be rated R or something like that these days, but that's good stuff. All right. Anyways, the tumult in the temple beginning in verse 27. Paul should not have gone to Jerusalem. Once at Jerusalem, Paul should not have gone into the temple to appease the Jews, but Paul's mistakes are now going to bring repercussions. Verse 27 to verse 32, the riot. A riot breaks out when Paul comes out of that temple. In verse 27, when the 7 days were almost ended, the 7 days of purification, followed by the animal sacrifice, the Jews which were of Asia. Now understand, the Jews which are of Asia are not believers. They are there, they are in Pentecost because of Pentecost, because of the Jewish feast. 50 days after the Passover, Pent. 50 days after the Passover is the Feast of Pentecost. And all these Jews have migrated back to Jerusalem to celebrate. They are not born-again Jews. They're not converted Jews. They're the Jews that have been scattered and live in Asia. They're the Jews from Ephesus and Thessalonica and Corinth that despised Paul and his message, that saw their fellow Jewish people cling to this religion Paul was preaching. They did not like him. And he has been set up by the elders at the church at Jerusalem. And he comes out of the temple, and the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. Now, laying hands on him is not talking about when they laid hands on Timothy and ordained him to the ministry. It's talking about they grabbed him by his cloak. They grabbed him by his garment. They grabbed him by his hair. They grabbed him and began to pull him in two different directions. And this is going to define the next few chapters of the book of Acts. Paul being pulled between two different factions. And it says that they saw him in the temple. They stirred up the people and laid hands on them. Number one, under the riot, we're calling this the accusation of the Jews. Verse 27 to verse 29. The accusation of the Jews. Many Jews from Asia had come to Jerusalem for Pentecost. They were the unbelieving Jews who had heard and seen Paul as he traveled through their cities, and they were already antagonistic toward him. It says in verse 28, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law in this place, and further brought Greeks into the temple." You can underline that, brought Greeks into the temple. Fake news. It's not true. He was in there with four men that had a vow on them. They were all Jewish men, probably taking the vow of a Nazarite by the Old Testament law of Moses. There were no Greeks in that place when Paul went in there. So this is a lie. It's false. And the law in the place, and further brought Greeks into this temple and hath polluted this holy place. No, he hasn't. It's a good thing they didn't have Twitter or Facebook back then, because people would have been reposting this and reposting it without verifying it or checking it out, because that's the way false rumors spread. And further brought Greeks into this temple and have polluted this place, for they had seen before with him in the city of Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed, you get this? They supposed that Paul brought into the temple. They're saying, as Paul comes out of this temple with these four Jews with the vow on it, that he had defiled the temple because he took a Gentile in there, because they had seen Paul walking through town one day with an Ephesian. And they supposed that he had taken that Ephesian into the temple with them. See how they're manufacturing their facts? They could be a press secretary for a president. They're manufacturing the information, manufacturing their facts. It's not true. They're taking what they saw in one place and applying it to another place. How dastardly is that? How dishonest. And yet that's what they're doing. The accusation of the Jews in verse 27 to verse 29. They have brought Greeks into the temple. You know, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. Was it, I can't remember his name now. The guy that wrote Huckleberry Finn. Mark Twain. I think it was Mark Twain that said, a lie will go all the way around the world while the truth is still putting its shoes on. All right, I think that was him that said that. A lie will go around the world while the truth is still putting his shoes on. And all you have to do is say something that sounds juicy, that sounds good, and people will run with it while the truth is still putting its shoes on. Be careful of that kind of information. Be careful. He had brought Greeks into this temple, hath polluted the holy place, for they had seen with him in the city of Trophimus in Ephesian, whom they supposed, they had seen, and they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. On the basis of that, number 2, verse 30 to 32, the assault by the Jews. The assault, and that's not the opposite of a pepper. It's a dad joke. All right. The assault. You know what my greatest pleasures in life is right now? Hearing my grandkids groan at their dad's jokes. When my two boys tell their kids jokes and tell their jokes to their kids, and the kids just look at them, and I hear it, I know it, it's a dad joke, and their kids groan. I think, yes, there is revenge in there somewhere. There's vengeance, and I didn't do it, so it's all right. The assault by the Jews, verse 30 to verse 32. And all the city was moved and the people ran together. This false information bound the multitude together. And then they took Paul and drew him out of the temple. And forthwith the doors were shut. And as they went to kill him, tidings came into the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar, who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. They went in and laid hands on him. They drug him out of the temple, because to kill him in the temple would be wrong. But to kill him outside the temple is okay. You see a problem with their thinking anywhere there? They drew him out of the temple and shut the doors and went about to kill him. Oh, how terrible it would be to kill somebody in the temple. But it's all right outside the temple. There's some twisted thinking. And as they went about to kill him, the chief tidings came to the chief captain. This guy's going to show up over and over and over and over again in the remainder of these next couple chapters, as Paul's whole adventure here in Jerusalem, his life is on the line. And he's but an inch between him and death. And all of this because he's in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong things, because he's out of the will of God. A great lesson for you and I. If the Apostle Paul, who is, without a doubt, 3,000 steps spiritually higher than we are, We're not trying to knock him down. He is the epitome. He is an example for us to follow. But we follow him when he follows Christ. And when he's not following Christ, we don't follow him. Same is true of anybody. Next week we'll continue here in Acts 21. Father, thank you for this story. Lord, it is a saddening story. It's always disappointing, Father, when one of our heroes, we get to see the bad side, the wrong side, whether it's David or Peter or any other. And Father, the Apostle Paul, who is without a doubt the greatest Christian that ever walked the face of this earth, Lord, to see that he made mistakes too and what they cost him. Lord, help us to learn from that example and be careful with every step that we take. May we remain when we keep ourselves focused on being in the will of God. Bless our morning service and those that come to join us in Jesus' name.